Hello there, and you're very welcome to Poem of the Week. Hello, I'm Morgan O'Reilly, and once again, you're very welcome to Poem of the Week. The series is a collaboration between Near FM, local poets, and members of the community. Each week, we will be celebrating poetry, both new and old, Irish and international, and published and unpublished work, alongside a significant date in our calendar. This week's poem is The Hare Steamship, written and read now by Francie Devine.
Since first light, we were there, cramped close against the Manchester shed at the south wall. A cloying dampness enveloping the keys, all eyes sifting the fog, watching the bar for the first sign of a heralded deliverance. The cold, slow bore, worms in a stair skirting, mother's thin shawleen insufficient to lag the bones, the fevered excitement of daybreak waning, belief in Jim challenged by rumour, begrudgery, and the sighting of false gods. Then, at a quarter to one, a port and docks board man, high on a steam shovel, glass to eye, spotted the streaming bunting, the flutter of the National Transport Workers' Federation flag, the steamship Hare butting into Liffey Mouth, entering history, bearing Larkin deep inside our souls. There was no disorder, but disciplined attendance, a silent respect for brothers Seddon and Gosling, important bowler-hatted Englishmen from the Trades Union Congress. A patient vigil rewarded by ticketed parcels containing £10 of potatoes and a further £10 of bread, butter, sugar and tea, jam and fish, all in boxes and bags with the letters CWS printed boldly on the side. Our mother shared out our ration with other unfortunates in the building, something that seemed unquestionably natural. There were biscuits for the childer, which we sat on a plate and would not eat, lest we had nothing left to admire. Jim had delivered us from hunger. Now we had to press forward to seize the promised land, knowing that our army could henceforth march on heart and belly. A half century on, I saw an old wizeny man stood outside the GPO on May Day with the other dribble drabble few, cheering Paddy Dunnigan and Sean Dunn, a gold shilling Cooperative Society medal swinging on his grease-shine lapel. When he told me he got this for crewing the Hare, I instantly saw his image in those digital photographs thousands unconsciously took on that dank, drear day in September 1913, as evidence that hope did once actually walk amongst us.
The Steamship Hare by Francie Devine, first published on The May Dancer, your second collection.
Second collection.
Francis, lovely to have you in the studio.
Thank you very much, Morgan.
Always fantastic to hear the poem read in its author's voice, I find. So we're commemorating the 1913 strike and lockout, and we're blessed that you've agreed to come in and share your poem with us. So not many people will be aware of even the title itself, The Steamship Hare. Can you just contextualise the poem?
Yeah, the Hare was the first of the food ships that came into Dublin, organised by the Trades Union Congress, British Trade Union Congress Food Fund, where they collected thousands of pounds literally from across the country, from different trade unions, progressive people. Some of it came here as money that was distributed as strike pay or lockout pay. But the remainder went to the CWS, the Cooperative Wholesale Society in Manchester, which made up food parcels that were then shipped to Dublin. So the poem is an attempt to sort of imagine what it must have been like. The lockout is underway, everybody's out of work, the money's running out, and Jim Larkin, this messianic figure, says, I'm going to bring a ship in. And I spoke when I was younger to people that had stood on the quay, and all sorts of rumours went round. There was a ship, there wasn't a ship. there was a ship, but Larkin was on it, and it had gone to America with all the money and stuff like that. And then the ship appeared. And it must have been really quite extraordinary that this man had the power to bring in a ship, but also that other people in other countries were collecting pennies and tuppences to send to us. And then the food, of course, arrived and was distributed.
I mean, in today's terms, a couple of £1,000, you're talking millions.
Yeah,
millions,
you were talking, I think we did a calculation once, it was umpteen million, in today's money. And proportionally at the time, the same. And you'll hear in the poem, the food parcels were actually quite substantial. Now, very basic, but fairly substantial. And there's no doubt that the resistance of the workers from late August through till February of 1914 was sustained to a considerable extent by the food fund, and that William Martin Murphy, the employers' leader, had purposefully chosen hunger as a weapon. And don't forget, Dublin already had very substantial levels of poverty.
Well, yeah, we were just chatting off air briefly there. I mean, and it is easy to forget. You're talking, we can all remember the school, the history from the school books. Worst slum in Europe, incredible
worst
levels
slums
of poverty.
In Western Europe, certainly. Highest infant mortality rates. I think in 1913, for example, well over 1,000 kids in Dublin died of causes that were directly related, you know, conspicuously related to malnutrition and poor diet and so on. So, yeah, Dublin was a pretty impoverished town. And that leads to the next point. Why was it that this ragged proletariat, living often in one room or sharing one room with others, could be galvanised in this fashion? And I think everybody now agrees, as historians agree, that what Larkin and Larkinism brought wasn't just a trade union, the transport union, but that hope that vehicle, the union, could actually change things. And certainly I think the spectacular thing of a ship coming up the Liffey showed you, in a sense, the power of solidarity. And that, I think, remains today within the Irish character.
Yeah, and I think the poem, you do capture it quite well. There's some biblical imagery there. Deliver us from hunger, you're drawing on, of course, the
Larkin in his speeches was very fond of biblical imagery. And I suppose, again, when you think of how much more limited media were in those days, for many people the Bible was one of the most read.
Sure.
It's also interesting that on a parallel scheme, when they tried to take children to Britain to give them relief by holidays, which was strongly opposed by church leaders and unseemly sights of priests and other zealots snatching kids from the quayside, Connolly took a crowd of kids up the following day to the bishop's palace and invited the bishop to show as much concern for their stomachs as he had for their souls. And that actually led to an increase in broad terms of food aid being generated in Dublin, from middle class sources, and realised these kids are starving. So that also occurred.
Tell us about yourself, Francie. You're a labour historian. I mean, you've published books on this, and not often people would find poetry the logical next step for the historian.
Well, the two for me run in parallel because my poetry has a lot of labour socialist scenes. I'm a Marxist, so that conditions the rest of my life. I was a trade union official with the SIPTU / Transport Union. I worked in the education and training department. And that led me into, researching. And, I wrote the history of SIPTU, Organising History, published by Gillan Macmillan, and a few other histories. But I've always written poetry. Mm. Or more accurately, poetry has written me, because I tend to find that I suddenly get a compulsion to get to a typewriter, word processor, and that's it. So.
And how do they compare? I'm just thinking of... Because this series in particular is our whole premise, our whole objective is to try and... memorialise and commemorate both poems and significant dates of our history. And of course, the lockout was an obvious choice.
Yeah, and in the Irish Worker, which was the weekly Transport Union paper, they used literature. There were regular poems, songs, Who Fears to Wear the Red Hand Badge being perhaps the best known. But also in the Christmas edition, 1912, they published a 40-odd page sort of special edition, which is exclusively prose poetry, and even, would you believe, the full texts of two plays. Mm. So a lot of the poems are written by ordinary people, and they're written by people that we know were dockers or clerks or whatever. So poetry was seen as part of the struggle. And in 1916, just to move on to that, you had people like Maeve Kavanagh, described by Connolly as the poetess of the revolution, who wrote poems almost on a weekly basis, generating an attitude towards the potential rebellion. So poetry was, you know, was quite there. And in the workers, Irish Worker, they published poems also from around the globe. So you'd have poems like Bread and Roses by James Oppenheimer, which turned into a song published. So they were quite international in their perspective.
That's a very interesting idea that these, I'm sure most of the members of these trade unions over 100 years ago probably didn't have third level education.
Certainly didn't have third level education, but we think there was a relatively good level of literacy. And you also feel that there was a sort of connection with literature.
Yeah.
The people enjoyed poetry. For example, in Liberty Hall, they had a workers' drama group and they would put on recitals and they put on plays and put on other events. But poetry was often read. And on the context of the national side of things, they would quote, you know, from people like James Clarence Mangan, etc. Yeah. And I can remember one of my first times ever in Dublin as an adult, going into the Earl Mooney or the Talbot Mooney for a cup of tea, one of the few places you get a cup of tea, walking in and realising I'm probably in the wrong place here. It's full of pretty tough-looking guys. And when I asked for a sandwich and a cup of tea, I was told to feck off. It wasn't Bewley's, you know. But the lad next to me at the bar says, are you a student? And I was a bit, if I confess to being a student, I'm going to get bet. And ordered the sandwich for me, so I knew I was okay. And he turned me round. And in the corner were about 10 to 12 dockers who'd gone in, signed on, but no ship. So they got their fallback pay and they're having a few pints before they went home. And I was asked to settle the following argument. How many languages did James Clarence Mangan, the poet, write in? And I'm not cutting you. And I think in those days there was a sort of an appreciation, certainly of Irish literature, amongst Dublin working class people. And you'd often hear fellas in pubs singing appropriate songs or reciting bits of poetry or being jocks or out of O'Casey or whatever. And O'Casey maybe is the best example that he comes from precisely that culture, you know. Yeah.
My first interaction with this poem was during the commemorations in 2013. Mm. And I think you appeared on a couple of...
RTE, Yeti Redmond, produced a series where she asked quite a lot of people to identify just what we've been talking about, poems and songs that had been written or read or understood in 1913, with a few exceptions. This was one of the exceptions because it was read afterwards. But, for example, I read a poem called It's Murphy's, which appeared in the Irish Worker, which basically sort of describe somebody being amazed by what he's seeing, like a new steamship or a new railway, and to be told it's Murphy's.
William Martin.
Yeah, and then at the end he goes to hell and he can't get in because it's Murphy's. You know, so that sort of humour, and again, that humour of lampooning the great and the good, back to this thing about people in those days, you know, society was very stratified. It appeared to be very permanent.
Yeah.
If you looked at somebody like William Martin Murphy, he owned everything. To lampoon him in a cartoon or to bring him down in a verse suddenly made him an opponent that was manageable as opposed to, you know, something beyond. Ernest Kavanagh, the cartoonist, was in the Irish Worker. Everybody's image of William Martin Murphy is probably his cartoon rather than an actual portrait of what was quite a kindly looking gentleman. But his cartoon of the vulture on Dartry Hall gates with the bloody worker beneath him is what most people remember.
Absolutely. And as we speak as well, you've just recently launched another book, the aptly titled...
This is called...
Outside Left.
And that's just been published. It was launched last Thursday. If anybody's listening, it'll be available in... Connolly Books in Essex Street and probably a few other places. Outside Left, for a variety of reasons, including that was my first position on a football field. And also, as the accent probably betrays, I'm an immigrant to Ireland, albeit of Irish extraction.
Yeah.
So in some senses, often feel outside. And if you're a left winger, you're undoubtedly outside, unfortunately.
The cultured left foot.
Cultured left foot. I like that, yeah, the cultured left foot.
Francis, thanks again for coming in. All the best and take care. Francis Devine is a Labour historian and poet. Francis' third collection of poetry, Outside Left, was published in 2017 by Omaskin Press. That's it from us for this week. A big thank you to this week's contributor, our production team and everyone at Near FM, and also to Paula Meehan for her advice and support on this series. Join us next time for Poem of the Week. Good luck and God bless.
Nearcast. Nearcast, your community podcast network. Listen to podcasts about society, people, poetry, board games, and many other topics. Subscribe to a program today. Learn more at nearcast.ie and find out how you can get involved.